sure that everything is working all right.
It works.
And if it does, I guess we can get started. Yeah, I think we're all right.
It works.
Let me begin by indicating that today is November 12th, 1998, and this is Jim Boning speaking with Arthur Mendolia at his home in Titusville, New Jersey, on the beautiful banks of the Delaware River. Unfortunately, in my file, I don't know when and where you were born.
Well, I was born in Brooklyn, New York, on May 6, 1917. And I left Brooklyn before I knew it was on Long Island.
I was going to ask you what your about your if you could tell me something about your parents and your family background.
Well, we've got a granddaughter who's getting married in about 5 weeks, and she worked for Tina Brown at the New Yorker for about a year, year and a quarter. She's a Dartmouth graduate, but she said, "God, this is a dead end job." So where did she go to school? She went to Parsons School of Design, and she's about finishing up. And the reason I'm telling you this story, practically my whole family was in the garment business in one way. My father was a dress designer and a coat designer. And the reason we moved from Brooklyn to Cleveland, Ohio, is he got a job in Cleveland. But my mother hated to be away from her family. And I don't know, after about probably 3 or 4 years, we moved back to Brooklyn. Well, my father was looking for a job in Brooklyn. He caught pneumonia and died when I was 7 years old. Mm. So I have the dimmest recollection of my father.
So you moved temporarily to Cleveland when you were very young.
Yeah, very young. I started grade school there. Matter of fact, my wife and I have often kidded we probably went to the same library, because there was a Doan School library somewhere near. And my wife used to go there, but hell, we didn't know each other.
Where in Cleveland was it?
This was on Superior. Matter of fact, it was near Magnolia Drive, so okay. Somebody couldn't spell Mendolia. Said, think of Magnolia. It was right near what's now, I think, Martin Luther King Road. Goes right up to Case Campus.
So you had an early... You were very early in your life associated with Case and didn't know it.
Well, you know, it's funny. The guy who lived next door to us, we lived on East 99th Street. I've never gone back there. But he was a Case guy, and he was a miler. And he went to work for Sohio. And when I had to make a decision on where I should go to college, I lived in Youngstown, Ohio when I went to high school. Carnegie Mellon was 65 miles to the east, and Case was about 65 miles north, and I went to Case mostly because it was the school that my next-door neighbor went to, God, probably 15 years before, the guy named Crawford. Nice guy.
Well, before we get to Case, let me back up a little bit. So you moved back to Brooklyn when you were...
7 years
seven
old.
7 years old?
Yeah.
And how long did you stay in Brooklyn then?
I stayed in Brooklyn for about... probably about four years. Then my mother remarried, and guess where we went back to? We went back to Cleveland.
Was there any reason why they ended up going back to Cleveland?
No. Well, that's something I don't have a good recollection of. My stepfather was a broker, and he earned his living in Cleveland. Now, how the hell he got hooked up with my wife? My mother, I really can't recall that.
Hmm.
But we went to Cleveland, and this was during the Depression, and God, at one point in time, he had a tough time earning a living, so he moved to Youngstown, Ohio, which is where I finished high school.
Okay.
And it was there that I made the decision to go to Case instead of Carnegie Tech.
What was it like going... Do you have any recollections of your grade school back in Brooklyn, or that
yeah,
anything that
you know,
influenced
you? I remember that more than anything else, because I had a couple of teachers, a guy named Mr. Gounod, G-O-U-N-O-D. He made a lasting impression on me. He was a good guy, good teacher, and but I only went to about the... fifth grade in Brooklyn, and then we moved to Cleveland. I finished up grade school in Cleveland, went to junior high, and then we moved to Youngstown, Ohio. So I finished up my junior high education in Youngstown. I went to high school there. But it was an interesting period. Why? Because there were World War I babies coming along. And the high school that I went to had two sessions a day. So I went in the morning, I had all afternoon, and there was no homework and no tests. So when I went to Case, I got the shock of my life. One is people expected me to work. And two is I really hadn't ever really had to study before. It was tough. It's a tough transition.
Did you have any science exposure in Youngstown?
Yeah, I took chemistry in the lab, and I got to tell you an interesting story. I got to know a guy named John Wheeler, who's the world's expert physicist on gravitation. And I met him probably about 40 years ago because he was the liaison between the DuPont and the making of the first atom bomb on Hanford, Washington. And my mentor at the time was assistant plant manager, so he got to know John Wheeler pretty well. So I read a document that said that John Wheeler had retired from Princeton when he was, I don't know, 65, went to the University of Texas at Austin, and was there for 10 years, and then he asked his wife, where do you want to live? And she said, Princeton. So he came back to Princeton, and Princeton gave him an offer. So I looked him up. The guy is now about 85 or 6 years old, but God, he's a buzzsaw. He still gives a lot of lectures. But the thing that was interesting about why he moved back to Princeton was because his wife liked Princeton. But he was an interesting guy. The most interesting aspect of it, and one, he asked me, and he was from Youngstown, Ohio.
Okay.
He said, did I sell the Youngstown Vindicator? I said, no, I didn't. But his father was a librarian and was head of the North Side Library in Youngstown, Ohio. You know, that, it's an interesting series of connections to Youngstown. And I haven't been back to Youngstown since about 1946. And it's changed a hell of a lot, I understand. It used to be a steel town like Bethlehem.
Yes, it used to be.
I saw somebody last week that went there about 2 or 3 years ago. She said, God, it's all leveled. The Mahoning River is no longer... It's there. It's clean. God.
Now, when you said your Case decision was based on your next-door neighbor, now, was that a neighbor in Youngstown?
No, a neighbor in Cleveland. When I was under 7 years old.
Okay, so it dates way back to that early time.
Oh, it does, yeah. Oh. Well, I remember going to see this guy, and I don't know whether he ran a quarter mile or a mile, but I went to the campus, this had to be in 1923, and seen this guy run. And his family was a hell of a nice guy. His name was Crawford, and so was he. And we used to keep in touch with the Crawfords. We did while we were in Youngstown. So,
now, this would have been, you entered Case, what, 1937?
34.
Okay.
34, and I graduated in 41 because I ran out of money a couple of times.
I was going to ask you how you financed this during the Depression.
It was tough, very tough. Matter of fact, the first job I got trying to earn some money, and jobs were tough to get in Youngstown because, God, the lines leading up to a job were long. The jobs would be filled before you ever got to the end of the line. But a next door neighbor of ours, I think, worked for Youngstown Sheet and Tube, and there was a subsidiary that made boxcars, riveted boxcars. So I got a job. He helped me get a job at the Youngstown Steel Door Company. I think the first day I went to that job, it was 17 below zero. And there was no heat in this building. And the noise, when I came home, my mother just about cried. She said, this guy, oil all over his face. But you know, it's hard to tell kids how tough the Depression was. It really was. I think unemployment in Youngstown, God, must have been 30%.
Yep.
Struggle. It was a tough struggle.
So you, when you first got to Case, you said it was a shock that you had to...
I had to work. Had to do homework and go to class all day. Just like Lehigh.
Had you selected a major when you went?
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting to me because I told you, I heard this gal from Exxon, and she put on a series of starting salaries. And she said the chemical engineers are getting paid more than chemists. Well, I don't know how I got this little pamphlet in the early 30s, which said the chemical engineers were the best paid engineers. You're 55 years later. Yeah. They still are. And so chemistry appealed to me, so I took chemical engineering. You had to make up your mind early in Case what the hell you're going to do, because the schools were all blocked off in those days.
What appealed to you about chemistry? You said you had a course in high school.
Well, I liked chemistry, and I still like it. Organic chemistry has always appealed to me. What about it did I like? I don't know. I really don't know. And it still appeals to me. I still read the ACS News Edition, and I read Science Magazine, and it's always interesting to read about the molecules there are today. God, it's unbelievable. But I liked it and still like it.
Did you have any mentors at Case, that anybody that influenced you?
Yeah, they did. The guy that was the most influential guy in my life was a fellow named Carl Prutton. He was the head of the chemical engineering department. And I became a good friend of his in his latter years when he left Case, and I think he headed up FMC's chemical business and Olin's chemical business. Matter of fact, I got to tell you a story that I've never forgotten. When I had an uncle that lived in Niagara Falls, and he's the guy that steered me toward Ressler and Hoslacker, and Don Notman, who was eventually the general manager of Elkem, was the plant manager, and so he lined up a date. And I interviewed DuPont in the morning, and I had a date to interview Olin in the afternoon. Well, DuPont offered me a job in the morning, and I canceled the date. And I've often wondered, what the hell would life look like if I'd got interviewed Olin in the morning? Those are one of those decisions you never know what the hell fate would bring.
Yes.
God. But he was my mentor and a hell of a good guy. And it was interesting because he was listed, I think in 1937, the IRS put the only list they've ever put out of the 1,000 highest paid guys in the United States. And Carl Prutton was one of them, because he was a consultant for Dow and for Lubrizol, had a lot of patents. And I don't know, he made $50,000 in 1935 or six, which was a hell of a lot of money. So when he left Case, he was a very astute guy, and he could put problems together, chemical engineering problems, and he knew how to solve the problems. It was interesting. The guys after that, some of whom had never been in industry, they couldn't even generate the problem, let alone the answer. It was tough. And you saw the difference between a guy who had a lot of experience in industry and one who didn't have any. It was interesting to see. But Carl Prutton was a hell of a nice guy.
What was Case like in the 30s?
In the 30s, there was a small school. My graduating class, I think there were about 125. When I took my first freshman physics class, the professor, who was an amateur meteorologist, he said, look on either side. He said, one of you is not going to be here.
What was his name?
I knew you'd ask that, God. I can't think of it, but I will.
All right. We can fill it in later.
He was a professor of physics. Interesting guy. In fact, he said, I say he was an amateur meteorologist. He said, if you want to forecast the weather, just say tomorrow's going to be just like today. You got a 50% chance of being right. And you know, with all the computers today, weather's such a micro deal that it's hard to forecast the weather any place. Damn hard.
Now, when you...
But it was small, a small school. Well, it's not a hell of a lot bigger now, even though it's part of Case Western Reserve. My wife went to Mather College, and it was fairly traditional in those days for a Case guy to marry a Mather girl. Lots of those marriages. And Case Western Reserve was our vicious rival. I think on Thanksgiving Day, nobody plays on Thanksgiving anymore, but that was the rival. And I've got to tell you another interesting story. Ohio State in the 30s lost two games to Michigan only 2 games in 2 years, but they fire the coach because he lost them to Michigan. And he brought all of his plug uglies up to Western Reserve. I got to know a few of those guys. And Western Reserve went to a bowl game, the
Sun
Bowl or something, in 1936 or 7. That was unprecedented. And they just cleaned up the rest of the league. Matter of fact, the rest of the league finally formed, I think it was called the President's League, which had Denison and Overland, where students played.
So you were in and out, you said, because of financial problems.
Yeah.
Would you go a year and stay out a year, basically?
Yeah.
Was there any financial assistance from the university?
No. And, you know, when my kids asked me, or grandchildren, what did I pay? I think tuition was only about $300, but that seemed like an enormous amount of money. Especially when I think, as a steel worker, I got paid the minimum, which was 70 cents an hour. And before Ruther, who the hell ever put the United Steelworkers, 70 cents was high.
That's right.
And you were lucky to have a job.
Did you get any help from your mother or your stepfather?
No, but I got a little help from my father. He left an insurance policy in trust when he died. But, God, that didn't last. $1,000 in those days was a lot of money.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, you indicated that you had only 2 interviews, or you had scheduled only 2 interviews.
That's all.
And
in DuPont, they were desperate. This was in 1941. Hell, they'd hire a body if it was warm, because people were leaving. To this day, I'll never forget why I got hired, because this plant up in Niagara Falls made sodium, metallic sodium, and I interviewed about 6 or 7 guys, and at least 2 of them asked me, how was sodium made? And I was electrolyzing salt solution instead of molten salt. And, God, you know, I thought about that, and, God, I was wrong as could be. I still got that chance.
Yeah. Well, somewhere I read that you, and I don't know whether you took the course or not, but you had, there was an elective at Case in electrochemical engineering.
Yeah, and I've got to tell you about that. The headquarters, the national headquarters for Electrochemical Society, is in Pennington, New Jersey. And I walked in there. I looked in this old building. I never noticed a sign of it, and I went in there. And it's still there, and I don't know why. It's there. Probably the executive director there, Pennington. But I took electrochemical elective. I worked on a senior problem for the recovery of sodium from sodium-filled valves, which were used during the war. And they had a lot of valves that they wanted to recover the sodium. And then I went to work for the electrochemical department, but I never worked in an electrochemical process any time in my career. I spent the 13 years I never worked. That was called a north plant to south plant.
I wonder if that, since Herbert Dow was a Case graduate, I wonder whether that electrochemical engineering was any of a Dow legacy, because Dow and Case had a very strong connection.
They had a very strong relationship. Probably did. And we learned a hell of a lot about Dow chemistry and the brines they had up at Midland, Michigan, and the separation. Because the physical chemistry was done at Case for the separation of magnesium from the Dow, the Midland brines.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were aware of Dow and its as a chemical company?
No, no, there was a strong relationship between Dow and Case for a long time. Probably still is. Matter of fact, I know it is, because I was on the Case of whatever they call it, the equivalent of Board of Trustees, but it isn't a Board of Trustees, for about 5 or 6 years, and one of the guys that was a fellow member was a Dow guy who had been growing up in the agricultural business of Dow, and he felt very strongly that the engineering group, which was then part of Western Reserve, really ought to have a preferred status, otherwise they were not going to get donations from it. And he persuaded the president of Case, which is a guy named Agnar Pitti, who came from Dartmouth as the provost. He persuaded them to put the damn thing up for a vote to make a school of engineering inside of a liberal arts and science. And I said, God, the odds of that succeeding are negligible. Well, the damn faculty voted something like 98-2. I didn't think you could get the faculty to agree on anything 98-2. And to this day, well, this is probably about 8 or 9 years ago, it's this K School of Engineering, part of the liberal arts, and it makes a lot of sense because you don't have a third of the guys leaving at the freshman year because if they said, God, engineering or math are too tough, they can just switch and go to the liberal arts end of the business and go on to get a law degree or medical degree.
When you interviewed at DuPont, yeah, what did they tell you you were going to do? I mean, was it, did they indicate Niagara Falls would be the place you would be assigned?
Yeah, DuPont was pretty well fragmented in those days. Matter of fact, departments really ran their own show with very little guidance from the top. So you knew damn well if you're going to get a job, you're going to get it in Niagara Falls. So that's where I got a job, and I started in the research laboratory, and I liked research. But I went in a lab with 13 people in it, and I was the only bachelor of chemical engineering. 11 of them were PhDs, one master's, and me. And I could say, God, this is not the place for me. So I pushed like hell to get into the production end of the business, and it took a year of a lot of prodding of the human resources guy, whatever he was called in those days, to get him to switch me into production. But I finally got that after about a year.
And before you move on to the production part, what was it like in this research group? What were you doing?
I enjoyed it. DuPont in those days was interested in making vinyl chloride. So one of the things I did was make polyvinyl chloride on a semi-work scale. I don't know, probably a 200 or 300 or 400 gallon vessel. And I also made the copolymer, which was diethyl fumarate. Matter of fact, I'll never forget that because we bought maleic anhydride, which came in a probably a 50 or 100 pound paper case, and I used to break it up. Well, the first time I broke it up, I went home at night and I couldn't read, worth a damn. And then I realized why maleic anhydride in those days was called toxilic anhydride. It paralyzed I said, God, I'm blinded for life. But I did, as a chemical engineer in the laboratory, I did the scale-up work. I did the semi-work scale. Matter of fact, I'll never forget, we were also making acrylonitrile from acetylene and HCN. And my pilot plant was right next to a guy who could smell HCN. And God, he'd blow a siren. So you'd have to run down where that. And I learned to and by the way, as you know, some people can detect HCN mm-hmm. and other people can. But I learned to detect it pretty fast. But I did the scale-up work, and I did the pilot plant work. And I did it all by myself. Because DuPont was losing people to Hanford, and none of us knew where the hell were these people going? Just didn't know. They were going to Project TNX or something like that. We didn't know where they were going. So, and DuPont at that point in time also built a chemical warfare service plant in Niagara Falls. None of us knew. They were making a mustard gas decontaminant, but none of us knew what the hell it was. You could smell it, though. You went into a movie theater. God, you could smell this, and you knew damn well it worked at the chemical warfare service plant.
You were the only chemical engineer in that research
group.
That's
right.
Everybody else was a chemist.
Bunch of nice guys and smart guys. All organic chemists. The guy with was the head of that group was a guy named Oliver Cass. And DuPont, while it thought itself as a company of inventors, had never honored its inventors. And somewhere around 40 years ago, they had a dinner for the people that had made the most inventions. And this guy, Oliver Cass, had something like 105 patents. Very sharp guy. But he was an organic chemist. Matter of fact, the other day when I went to the ACS meeting, Union Camp has closed their R&D facility here in Princeton, on Princeton Pike. I don't know, they let 185 people. They just said, we're not going to do any more R&D. They're going to sell the building. And he was a mass spec guy. And I said, God, when I started work for DuPont, my job was to analyze by distillation. We used to make tetrachlorethane and trichlor. I had to analyze it. It took me a week to analyze it, and nobody gave a damn about the answer. Now you're sticking to the mass spec or grass chromatogram, and God, the answer comes out all. So, yeah, the world has changed a hell of a lot.